I am Planta on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Libby Davies joins me again. She has just published a new book, Outside In, a Political Memoir. It's a great read because it chronicles her early years in politics, beginning in the 1970s as a community organizer in Vancouver's downtown east side, known as Skid Row back then. She discusses her partnership with Bruce Erickson, One That Yields a Son, as well as the political activism that propels both of them to Vancouver City Council, where she served from 1982 to 1993. She ran for mayor in 1993, losing, and soon after lost Erickson, who died in 1997, the same year she was first elected to the House of Commons. The book talks about her advocacies, the causes she championed, be it homelessness, workers' rights, and ending drug prohibition, among others. The book is useful in how it chronicles a lot of history that would have otherwise gone unwritten about. It is also fascinating in how it gives the reader a unique perspective in how politics works, either here in Vancouver or in Ottawa. Libby Davies was the MP for Vancouver East until 2015 when she retired. She was also deputy leader of the New Democratic Party. Named a member of the Order of Canada in 2016, Ms. Davies is Canada's first openly lesbian MP. The Twitter handle is @LibbyDavies. This new book is published by Between the Lines. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Libby Davies. Ms. Davies, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
So as I was telling you just before we started, how much I enjoyed the book, because there was a lot of history in your career, that would have gotten lost if you hadn't put it down.
Yeah, it's actually, Joseph, one reason I wanted to write is that I realized that some of the early history about the downtown east side, well, it was known as Skid Row way back in the early 70s and before, that I wanted to, you know, put that down, some of the experiences of how it kind of went from being like no man's land to becoming a neighborhood, and a neighborhood with a voice, even though there are still many challenges in the area. So that was one of the reasons I want to write, because I was so young at the time that I'm one of the few people that's left. Luckily, Jean Swanson's still around. She's now on City Council, but many people have gone. So I felt like, well, this is a story that needs to be told.
And it was 1968 or 69 that you came to Vancouver for the first time?
I came to Canada in 1968 and to Vancouver a year later in 1969. So, yeah, I've been here a long time. It's home, for sure.
Yeah. So growing up with your mom and dad, was that, say, a politically minded house or an active household, say?
Yes, I think so. Both of my parents were always very politically aware. My dad was always, active and involved in sort of Labour Party politics, even when we lived overseas. I always remember them voting for the Labour Party, you know, because they were from Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of my foundation about being aware of what's going on around me and sort of looking at it through a progressive political lens really comes from that family history and some of the adventures I had, particularly with my father. And when we came to Vancouver, I mean, the very first election I got involved in, 1972, that resulted in Dave Barrett's government, it was at the urging of my dad, who was also involved in doing that legendary door-to-door canvassing that the NDP does. So that's where I kind of got my early beginnings, I guess.
Yeah, and what struck me as I was reading the book is a lot of the issues, especially in the early part of your political career, when you were running here in Vancouver, and you won a seat on council, you were an alderman then, that a lot of the issues that you confronted, that you folks confronted as a city then, I mean, there are a lot of the same issues today.
I know, and it's both astounding and rather shocking and makes you really think about what is it that's going on. I mean, I do need to say, Joseph, that, I mean, over those, well, nearly five decades, I mean, there have been many changes. I mean, the amount of social housing that's been built, for example, in the downtown east side, the fact that there is the Carnegie Center. You know, when I first started working there when I was 19, there really wasn't a serious drug issue or an overdoses. There were other issues, and people weren't as poor as they are today. So, you know, there have been improvements, but there's also been setbacks. I mean, obviously, sort of the two waves of the drug crisis, like beginning in around 1997 when I got elected as MP, and now again we see this enormous toll and human tragedy of all these overdoses, not only in the downtown east side, actually, but elsewhere, indeed across the country and even in the United States. So it's a huge, huge issue that needs to be taken up. But, you know, the neighborhood is still, I think what's remarkable is it's a very resilient neighborhood. Mm. And although there's lots of suffering and people who are in distress, it's a neighborhood that does have a voice, and it's a neighborhood that's willing to find its resilience to stay as intact as it can as a community. And I think that's been a very important change, because most neighborhoods like this in North America have been wiped out. You know, right. They either got gentrified or they got, you know, hollowed out, and they're just derelict areas. So it was kind of a different story here, and I do think it's because the residents, the people who live there, found their own voice and, you know, literally fought back.
Yeah. When I take the bus, I live on Fraser, so I take the 8 yeah. bus, and so it passes through Maine and Hastings. I always look to my left, and I see the Bruce Erickson building there.
Yeah, yeah.
What is that like for you and your son Leif when you're down there to see that?
Well, we love that building, and they have all those words on the balcony, you know, hope mm. and vote and community and that the residents themselves came up with. And Bruce's mural that was originally painted on the hoarding of the Carnegie Center and then moved inside the building and lay sort of derelict for a few years is now inside Bruce Erickson Place. Bruce restored it before he died mm. in 1997. And so that mural has been preserved, the lore and its majestic quality, which I quote in the book. And, in fact, there's a photograph of it, I think, on the beginning page. So, mm-hmm. You know, when I look back on those days, we had many a battle. But that particular saying by Anatole France from one of the 1885 or something, it really resonated with us about, you know, how the law can be so contradictory. Like the law applies to everybody, but, of course, there are people who get caught up in law enforcement, and there are people who, you know, who never have to worry about it because of their privilege and their class and so on. So we were always very aware of that, and it's something that stayed with me throughout my political life in terms of the issues I work on.
Well, one of the things that I enjoyed in the book was when you write about Bruce Erickson, and again, mm-hmm. another significant figure because he's been gone for 22 years now,
yeah. mm-hmm.
largely forgotten. You know, you see his picture there, I guess, on the wall in front of that building. Most people don't know who he is. When did you first meet?
I met Bruce in 1973. It was my second summer working in the Downtown East Side, and I was working on a paper called The Downtown East. And as I outline in the book, I was sent over by my co-workmates over to the First United Church, where we'd heard there was this fella who was an artist, a self-described artist, and might do some cartoons for us. And so I went, and they said to me, Libby, you go over and talk to him. You're so nice, he won't be able to say no to you. And so I went over, and that's how I met Bruce. And, of course, he then became, you know, he loved the paper. And then I basically stayed on. And as DERA, the Downtown Eastside Residents Association, was forming, I just stayed on. I mean, I loved what Bruce was doing. I guess we fell in love, and we stayed together for 24 years and had a son, Leif Erickson.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we worked together on many issues, and then were elected to city council.
Yeah, that's the thing that I'd forgotten about him, was that he was
yeah.
an artist, too, and
yeah.
so well-read.
Yeah, he had a grade 3 education.
Yeah.
And I remember Bruce used to read the dictionary at night. Very, you know, a totally self-educated man and very
yeah.
skillful. I mean, he was an artist, but when he retired from City Hall politics, he started making the most extraordinary furniture.
Mm.
So I'm very happy and lucky that I have this beautiful furniture and carvings that he did. And so he definitely has that kind of personal legacy as well. So he was a very unique individual in our city, and he had a big impact.
Yeah, and you write about those years. I mean, I guess Harry Rankin had already been on council in 1968.
That's right.
And then he got elected, and then you followed
yep.
him. And but I mean, the four of you mentioned Gene Swanson earlier. The four of you really, for a lot of people, were Cope. Were, you know, you were their voice for the longest time. And it seems like fun. It was awfully hard work and, you know, a hard slog to make it in politics then. But did you guys have fun at all?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I think I used the phrase in the book that my life flew by like a multicolored dream in a few seconds. I mean, it all happened so fast. You know, we ran and ran to city council and got defeated and defeated and eventually got elected. And then it's like, oh, my God, we're up at City Hall. What do we do now? I mean, nobody trained us. It was all sort of fly by the seat of your pants and learned by trial and error. But we got the hang of it. And, you know, the COPE years, those early COPE years of council with Mike Harcourt and Bill Yee.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there was some pretty, you know, those were heady days. It was like just prior to Expo 86, and there was all the non-union construction going on the Expo side and you know, concern about housing demolitions and long-term residents being pushed out, just as we see today.
Yeah.
So it was, I mean, I just remember, like, never having a minute, you know, to think about anything. It was just like, do. And so actually writing a book like this is very good because it helps you reflect, because when you're away from it, and this is true of Ottawa as well, it's helped me think about these experiences I had and what do they mean. And I wanted to write about, you know, how does change happen? How do we work together in a better way? And I wanted to share those sort of thoughts and experiences with people, because people feel so cynical about politics, and yet we all want to see things happen, right? So to me, it's a matter of, like, how do we engage with each other? How do we engage even with our adversaries? So I hope that some of that comes out in the book, to give people a sense that we can engage in the political world and we can actually, have a big impact on change that happens.
Yeah, and there's great advice there, because you tell your story. I mean, not only as a woman, a young woman in politics, but again, mm-hmm. as a young person in politics, as you were when mm-hmm. you first started out, there were a lot of challenges. And in terms of overcoming those, I mean, that can be very instructive for people, especially when we're talking nowadays about a more inclusive politics.
Yes.
There are a lot of lessons in your own career that are worth reflecting on, right?
I hope so, yes. And again, at the time, I didn't really think about those things, like what it was like to be a woman, a young woman in politics,
mm-hmm.
Even going to Ottawa. I mean, I didn't think about it. It was just like, get on and do it. And so it's only been later on that I've been sort of thinking through what these experiences have been about. And there are still challenges. I mean, Parliament is not a representative place of Canadian society overall. There's still lots of challenges for women in politics. It has changed. There's now younger women. When I first got elected, there was 62 women in the House of Commons. When I left in 2015, there were 72.
Mm.
And in the last election, 2015, there were 90 women elected. So we're still below 30%. Which the UN says that 30% is what they call a critical mass to bring about any sort of systemic change where there's been underrepresentation. So we still have a ways to go, and there are still challenges for women in politics, as there is in the media and elsewhere. But I do feel that there's a new generation of leadership emerging, and what I kind of put up with, and in some ways let go and dismissed in my early days, that wouldn't happen now. I think this new generation of leadership and young women are willing to call out when they see that there's discrimination. And I think that's really good. It's changing the body politic. It's changing the public discourse. And that, I think that's a healthy thing.
Even though
it's sometimes very stressful.
Right, right. You also write in the book about working across the aisle, especially in Ottawa. You develop relationships, say, with people like Claudette Bradshaw when she was the minister, mm-hmm. Rona Ambrose.
Mm-hmm.
That's really something that struck me, because we all know Ottawa for question period.
Yes,
and
exactly.
There's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes and a lot of constructive work and by all parties, right?
You've hit it right on, Joseph. I mean, I totally wanted people to know that what people see of Canadian politics is, you know, a few clips of question period where it's like a slugfest, you know, it's like, you know, scoring points, who wins, who loses, who's going after who. And so that becomes our view of politics in Canada by and large. And it's correct that there are many other opportunities to work across the aisle. And so that was a very important lesson for me, that developing solid relationships, even with your so-called political adversaries, was very important, and it was the way to get things done. There's no way that I would have been able to gain visibility on issues around the war on drugs or on homelessness and housing and such like, unless I'd been able to develop some of those relationships and find a way to work in that environment. And that's again another message that I wanted to come out in the book, that we have to work on the outside and the inside. We can't just like forego it and say, well, you know, we're upset about it, we don't like all these politicians. If we say that, then we're basically, you know, leaving power to people who already have it, right, and who do have sort of the inside track. So if we want to open it up, if we want to make politics more accessible for ordinary people, average people, then we have to engage. And I really wanted to share that kind of thought and experience in the book.
I mentioned Claudette Bradshaw. She was the, yes. I guess, the social housing minister during the Chrétien years. And
yes.
And there's something very instructive or informative in your book. She tells you to not let up during question period because that'll give her leverage at the cabinet table. And that's something that's so fascinating for those of us that watch politics, that because it's that rock'em sock'em stuff that we see, as we've talked about already in the news, that that can be helpful, right? That can affect change.
Well, it depends what's being asked. I mean,
if it's
something, a horrible controversy, okay. Do you remember when James Stewart was the minister of HRTC?
Right,
and although they called it the billion-dollar boondoggle of the Conservatives, which is merciless, going after, even though she had not been the minister responsible for it. It had been the previous Liberal minister.
Yeah.
But because she was the minister then, so, I mean, that kind of hounding, you know, is very difficult to deal with. But what Claudette was saying to me was, you know, I want to do something on this, and you kind of, you know, raising this in question period and pushing it helped me gain leverage with my colleagues. And so she got it, I got it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you kind of form those understandings and alliances. And, you know, I've on occasion, you know, gone and talked to government ministers and said, you know, this is what I'm planning to do. You know, can I get your support? I did that on the compensation for the thalidomide survivors.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty well the last thing I did in Ottawa. I mean, I went and talked to the Minister of Health and said, this is what I'm going to do. This is the motion. Will you agree to it? So that it wasn't sort of like a one-shot thing that would be shut down in the House because it was so partisan. And that I do feel that is a problem, that things have become so hyper-partisan in the House, and we're seeing that now. I wish it weren't so much that way, that there was more collaboration.
Uh-huh.
But it takes a lot of, you know, it's hard, right? Because it's we live in a very partisan world, and you know, it's just the nature of the way it is. But I still think there's room to develop that more respectful way of doing politics, and I think everybody has to work at that.
A lot of people will read the book interested in what it was like to work with Tom Mulcair as leader.
Yeah.
It's very instructive in the book when you talk about working with leaders like Mulcair and Jack Layton,
mm-hmm.
about how you as a caucus member have to show that loyalty that
mm-hmm.
you have to do. And, you know, there were obviously differences that you had with Mulcair, but at the end of the day, you write that he was a good leader to work for, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was very loyal to him. I did have disagreements with him. And sometimes, you know, we did wonder, and I say this in the book, you know, who did he listen to?
Mm-hmm.
And he's a complex character. You know, on the one hand, he was very masterful in the House, you know, staring down Stephen Harper on various scandals and, like, really forcing him to provide answers. And then in other instances, you know, we felt like, you know, he needed to be out there more, engaging with people. I mean, definitely his forte was in the House as the parliamentarian and the leader of the NDP. So I have a lot of respect for Tom. And when he, I didn't support him when he ran as leader. I supported another candidate, Brian Topp. Uh-huh. But when he was elected as leader, he had my total support. And that's, you know, I think it's very hard for people to understand the weirdness and the complexities of what a caucus is all about,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
It really is like your extended family. And like a family, you have squabbles, you have fights, and there are siblings who don't get along. And I mean, it's really so similar to a family dynamic. But at the end of the day, you know, basically you're still a family. And I think that's in some ways more true for the NDP than maybe it is for other parties. That's always been my sense about it. And so being a part of caucus, you do have that sense of sort of team loyalty. And so when you do disagree, you know, it does become a dilemma of, where and when do I speak out? How do I do this? And I try to illuminate some of that. I didn't go into it a lot,
yeah.
But I wanted to give people a sense of what it's like. And I always used to say to people when I was out giving speeches at various events on politics, I would always say the biggest politics was internal, right?
Mm.
That people, of course, don't see. It's inside the caucus and all the debate that goes on and the, you know, the pull and the push and, are we going to do this? Are we going to do that? And do we support this? Or are we going to oppose that? I mean, that's where the real interesting stuff goes on. But of course, it is, you know, caucus meetings are always confidential for every party. So it's something that you kind of, you work it out behind your doors.
Yeah. What,
again, just like a family right. does often.
Yeah. Because there was great success for the NDP in 2011 in that election. And then in 2015, obviously that changed. Where do you see, I mean, a lot of people might blame Tom Mulcair for that. You in the book talk about the direction of the party that, you
yeah.
know, as everybody moved to the right in the 90s on, the NDP did as well. They moved to the center,
yeah.
I guess. And so, I mean, that could be blamed for what happened in 2015.
One reason. Yeah, it's one factor.
What do you, going into an election this fall, I mean, how do you think the NDP can do better, say?
Oh, I think we must do better. I think we have to be very bold. We have to take on some of these big issues like global warming and be very upfront with people about, you know, what it is that we're facing here in Canada and globally. I think the time is over for, you know, empty words and sort of rhetoric around the issue. And I truly believe that the NDP is the party to take this on because we do have a relationship, a longstanding relationship with the labor movement and with working people generally. And there are huge issues about how we transition from a to a post-fossil fuel economy and how that's done. You know, you can't just throw people under the bus. You can't just, ruin people's lives and their families, you know, when people have got mortgages and they've had a history, you know, maybe in the oil and gas sector or whatever it might be. There has to be a just transition. And so I think the NDP has got to be the party to be a major player in that and making it clear that we need to build a very different kind of economy. So I think it's going to be a very key issue. You know, you've got the Conservatives in Ottawa and across the country are even fighting the carbon tax. So I think it's going to be a big issue, and I want to see my party be very bold about it, right? I feel like that's what we have to do. I've met some of our candidates across the country. I've been very impressed that, again, there's sort of a new generation of young people who are stepping forward. I was just in Toronto and met a number of candidates, and it was like, wow, these folks are really stepping up, and they get it. And also they want to do politics differently. So I feel a sense of hope about that. But still, we'll have lots of challenges. You know, the polls are difficult. But as we always say, the only poll that counts is the one on election day.
Yeah.
But we got a lot of work to do.
Right. Now, your former colleagues, Sven Robinson, is running again. If he can, have you given thought to, say, doing it again? I mean, you're bandied about last year for running for mayor. By the way, did you give that serious thought?
I did. I really did. So many people encouraged me. I thought, well, I need to think this through, and I really did. But I decided at the end, and I was very excited about it, but at the end of the day, to take on something like that, you have to give it like 150%. And I was already in the middle of writing my book, and I thought, well, I just don't know if I've got the same kind of energy to do it that is needed. So I just made a decision not to. I won't be running federally. I'm delighted to see that Sven is. I think he's already out there raising some of these issues. And, he has a very strong reputation. People listen to him. So I think he's a very serious candidate in North Burnaby Seymour. So I'm very hopeful that he'll be back in the House, and I think he'll play a very important role, not only within the NDP, but within the Canadian Parliament. I mean, I think he has that kind of stature.
Yeah. You're retired from active politics, if you will, but what are some of the things that you're doing in your retirement, other than, say, flogging this book?
Well, I hope to continue writing, but I'm still active on a number of the issues that I talk about in the book, particularly as it relates to the Downtown East Side. Of course, in a less formal sense, I'm not really in the media much these days, and that's fine by me. But I'm still very engaged with these issues and helping people, working with people. For example, the whole issue in Vancouver that people are now talking about, safe supply. I mean, 20 years ago, the whole thing was to get InSight opened.
Right.
Now people don't blink an eye to that. But now the issue is, people is ensuring that there's a safe supply so people aren't literally being poisoned to death in the illegal drug market. So I'm still very involved in some of these issues, which I like. I don't have to fly back and forth to Ottawa,
right,
which is good. But I'm a political animal, so I'll always be involved. And I do some speaking. I seem to do a lot of advising. I get lots of people phoning me saying, well, what do you think about this? And can I come and see you? And I always say, sure, find the time. So I've been actually very busy, but it's, as they say, so many people who are, quote, retired, they say, oh, I've never been so busy. And amazingly, I feel that way myself. But it's been good. I mean, I was ready to go from Ottawa, so I don't regret that decision at all.
The what I found refreshing about your memoir is that you do name names. You give credit to people who deserve credit, and then you take people on that deserve taking on, whether it's, say, Stephen Quinn, for example, for an interview. That's awfully refreshing, because a lot of memoirs that I read will probably, leave some names out. What was the motivation in terms of your part? I don't think getting even was necessarily something that you had in mind. But
no, it wasn't getting even. It was really just trying to, again, get across this experience of what politics is about and what it's like to live that life, and that there are many ups and downs, and I wanted people to know that, like in politics, people have this incredible expectation. And if you screw up, like, people are merciless, not only politicians on each other in the House, but sometimes the public. And I wanted to get across this idea that, we all make mistakes. I've screwed up. I've made mistakes. And it's not all a bed of roses. And it's just like any other workplace, right, where, you live and learn. And, of course, everything you do is public. That's the only difference, or most of what you do is public. But I wanted to talk about the people I worked with because, it's not so much about me. It's about the issues and this journey. And, I wouldn't have been able to do the things that I did if I hadn't been able to work so closely, particularly with people in the community, people that, other people have never heard of, but they were so important in the work that was taking place. And so to give that credit, I mean, I've read many of these kind of memoirs where, the person says, well, I did all this, and you'd think that they were on the stage alone.
Right.
Well, there's many players, and we have different roles. And I always saw myself as an ally for the people in the community who were really, particularly groups like VANDU, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, who were really changing the debate in Vancouver and then across the country on how we see people who use drugs. I was their ally. I didn't do that on my own. Mm. They did it. I was there to support them. So I think, that's a very key difference.
Yeah, congratulations on this book, Libby. It's a great read, and it's a necessary history that I think all of us need to read in the city and beyond.
Thank you so much.
And I hope it's not another 14 years before we talk again.
I hope not. Well, thank you so much for the interview, and I'm glad you've enjoyed the book, and I appreciate the questions you asked me. They were all great.
The book is called Outside In, a Political Memoir. It is published by Between the Lines. It's author Libby Davies. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planto.